This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are some 42,000 men and women now serving time in Michigan prisons. The sheer size of our inmate population can make it way too easy to lump these men and women into some amorphous mass of wrongdoers. And that can lead to the lock them up and throw away the key mindset that's informed our criminal justice system for decades. But don't you find yourself wondering, what happened? What was it that transforms a bright-eyed child to a killer with dead eyes pulling a trigger? When you open to the first page of Shaka Singor's powerful memoir, you'll start to get the answer to that question. Going through this memoir, you'll learn how little James White went from an honor student with dreams of being a doctor to Jay, a crack dealer who murdered a man and then spent nearly two decades as prisoner number 219184 in Michigan prisons. Today, he is Shaka Singor, a leading criminal justice reform activist, a mentor to youth, and a leader in helping victims and violent offenders heal through the power of the arts. His new memoir is Righting My Wrongs, Life, Death, and Redemption in an American Prison. And we should note, and it's very significant, it's W-R-I-T-I-N-G, My Wrongs. Shaka, it's so good to have you with us on Stateside.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really honored to be here.
I have to tell you, I cannot recall when I have read a memoir where the writer is so open and so honest about how he messed up and where and when he went wrong, and then this incredible level of confession and soul searching and self-understanding and ultimately atonement. But then you had 19 years of sitting in cells to do all of that soul searching.
Yeah, I mean, when you're incarcerated, you have a lot of time to do a lot of things. You know, I don't want people to walk away thinking that putting people in cells are the answer to soul searching. It's really all about who you are at the core of your being. And those were some of the questions that I had to wrestle with, is that how did I go from being this honor roll student to serving out my most promising years in a prison cell? And it was through that questioning that I began to discover what went wrong.
Well, let's get out the basics and then dive into what went wrong. An honor student named James. You became a crack dealer at 14, yeah, who called himself Jay. It sounded tougher than, yeah, James. At 17, you were shot three times. Yeah. 14 months later, you became the guy holding the gun and squeezing the trigger. You killed a man, sentenced to 15 to 40 years. So by October of 1991, you were there in the first of so many Michigan prisons, the, yeah, Michigan Reformatory in Ionia. What was that 19-year-old like?
Going into prison, I was confused. I was emotionally confused. I was angry. I was bitter. I felt abandoned. I felt neglected. I didn't want to take responsibility. And so walking into prison in the Michigan Reformatory, which was at that time arguably one of the most violent prisons in Michigan, if not in the country, I realized that there were ways that this anger would manifest that would be very unhealthy. And it's kind of like the rule of the yard. It's the jungle. It's the law of the jungle. It's a very volatile environment. And it's the perfect setting for somebody who's angry and bitter to continue to act up and continue to act out. And when you don't have those emotional coping skills, it's easy to just turn your life into a bigger mess.
Why did that 19-year-old think he was incarcerated? Whose fault did he think it was?
That night, you know, well, that day, the first day of walking in prison, the mindset I had then is that it was everybody's fault except for mine. It was the victim's fault. It was the person who brought the victim to my house. It was my parents' fault for allowing me to slip through the cracks. It was the teacher's fault who weren't aware, you know, or who ignored, who I felt ignored signs of abuse. It was everybody's fault but mine. And at 19, when you aren't fully matured emotionally or mentally, it's easy to place blame everywhere else except for yourself.
Your book takes us back right to the beginning. Give us a sense of how you first broke. You were a little boy that wanted to be a doctor, an honor student. What was going on when you were a small child that began this sense of began breaking you?
Well, my parents, they went through a back and forth kind of separation, and my mother didn't handle that well. You know, the thing about my mother that I later learned is that my mother had been through every type of imaginable abuse a child could endure. She got married very early and was in a very volatile domestic relationship. And so her ability to manage her children came out of her personal experiences. Now, at the time when these things were happening, I wasn't aware of this. I wasn't aware that she had been brutally beat and she had been through so much, had been the victim of so many violent acts. And so as a child, you don't know these things. And so when she would abuse us, I felt like there was something wrong with me. Like there had to be something wrong with me that would make her treat me in this manner.
And tell you, I wish you'd never been born.
Yeah. And so I grew up, you know, I was always a very helpful, thoughtful, caring, and compassionate child. But when I would experience these things and there was no outlet, because, you know, in a lot of environments, there's normalized behavior. And it was normalized behavior in our household. And so not having an emotional outlet to really say, you know, this is hurting me. This is like doing harm that's potentially irreversible. At, you know, as a child, you don't know how to express those things. And if you grow up in it, like I'm not the first child, so I'm number 4 out of 6 where, you know, when I'm growing up, I'm already seeing this happening to my older siblings. So this is normalized behavior. So there was just no outlet to express the type of hurt I was experiencing.
And it blew up by the time you were 14. You had had it and you hit the streets.
Yeah.
And it was so powerful and emotional for me as a reader. I think about how young a 14-year-old is. You didn't have any way to have any money. You were shuffling around in filthy clothes and just no options until you met the drug dealer who said, hey, I'll pay you.
Yeah, and the reality is that this happens to inner city kids all the time. Children who run away are some of the most vulnerable in our country. And they're oftentimes exploited in a myriad of ways. You know, if you think about sex trafficking, oftentimes those are runaway kids who get taken advantage of by, you know, seasoned predators and seasoned hustlers. And it's no different with drug trafficking. When I grew up, you know, all of the guys that ended up selling drugs and doing a lot of time, they started off as young kids. And when you're out on the streets and you don't have no way to take care of yourself and you don't have no way to provide for yourself, and here you have, an older, you know, teenager, young adult who has all the trappings of success telling you, hey, here's a way to provide for yourself. You can eat. We'll clothe you. You'll be able to have money in your pocket and you'll be able to take care of yourself. It's not that hard to seduce a child who's already, you know, in a very vulnerable emotional state. It's not hard to seduce them into that lifestyle. And that's what happened with me at 14.
And you take us very clearly how you were drawn into that. And then came an event that, again, when you think how young a teenager is and how vulnerable, and I'm wondering if you would read a passage from your memoir, because this is when you were shot. You took 2 bullets in the leg and 1 in the foot, and you were taken to the hospital. I'm wondering if you would read that passage for us.
When the doctor arrived, I felt a sense of relief, thinking that with him I could let down my guard and express my fears like the child that I was. But I was quickly reminded that we live in a cold and indifferent world. The doctor looked at my chart and left without saying much to me, returning moments later with a pair of needle-nose pliers. He dug the pliers into my flesh and wrenched a bullet from my leg, pulling bits of meat and bone with it. He irrigated it, then left to write a prescription for some antibiotics. I dozed back off under the influence of more painkillers and was awakened later by my father, stepmother, and mother. My father's eyes were full of hopelessness, and I could see that my mother was paralyzed by fear. They were clearly at a loss for words. After all, what could they have said to me? There aren't any parenting manuals that explain how to handle your child getting shot in the streets like a rabid dog. So we talked briefly about me coming home and leaving the street life alone, a plan that we all knew wouldn't happen. Then they all left. Throughout the whole ordeal, no one hugged me. No one had counseled me or told me that everything would be okay. No one came to talk to me and explain all the emotions I was feeling. No one told me that if I didn't find a way to deal with the fear I felt, I would become paranoid, would reach a point where I would rather victimize someone else than become a victim. No one explained to me that cars weren't galloping chariots of death driven by the Grim Reaper himself. So I coped in the only way I knew how. I became angry, and for the first time in my life, I began carrying a gun with me everywhere I went. 14 months later, I would be the one pulling the trigger.
That's Shaka Singhur reading from his memoir, Righting My Wrongs, Life, Death, and Redemption in an American Prison. No one talked about PTSD. No one, as you say, gave you a hug. And there you were 14 months later, pulling the trigger. Tell us about that night.
That night is a night that I will forever be haunted by. On that night, you know, tragically, two families were changed forever. And a man lost his life. You know, and you know, often when I mentor young men and women in the community, you know, I tell them that, you know, you can steal something from somebody, you know, but you can repay them for that. You can say something mean to somebody and you can apologize to them. But when you take a life, there's no bringing that person back. And so I'll forever be haunted with the reality that, you know, I caused a family some of the most devastating hurt that you can imagine. And it drives my work today. Because I never want another child to ever have to live with that burden of knowing that they've taken somebody else's life. And so on that night, I was coming home from DJing a party. An incident occurred at the party where somebody got shot out front, so we all left the party. And so I was already a little bit on edge because of the shooting at the party. When I arrived in my home, one of a person who used to buy drugs from me frequently, he came and attempted to purchase some drugs, and he brought two people who I didn't know. And so we got into an argument about him bringing people to my house that I didn't know, because that just wasn't how I did business. And, you know, it's one of those rules of drug selling. You know, drug selling, like any other business model, has its rules and regulations. And that argument escalated, and one of the passengers in the car joined in the argument. And we exchanged, you know, some very hostile, volatile words. And then I began to walk toward home. And I took one step, and all I remember was the car door opening. And I immediately flashed back to getting shot 14 months prior. And I turned and fired what turned out to be four fatal shots.
And as you say in your book, when you were sentenced to 15 to 40 years by the judge, you say you'd been a fool, that you'd been rolling the dice and gambling with your future, and the game was over.
Yeah.
When you think, Shaka, of your 19 years in Michigan prisons, and a lot of them, it just stunned me, you were bounced around like a pinball all over the prison system. What are the words, what are the adjectives or the thoughts that come to mind if you could try to give us a sense of those years in prison?
My years in prison were, especially my early years, was very volatile. Prison is such a brutal place for a child whose mind and brain is still developing. And when I grew up in prison, I grew up during the era where it was arguably at its most violent. And so it's a scary place to be. It's a very bitter and angry environment. It's hopeless. There's no compassion for self and others. And so my first years inside was just really hard and I guess it's interesting because so many people think that that's what prison should be. But in reality, I came from a hard environment. You know, I came from an environment where young people are killed every day, where violence is a norm. I came from an environment where brutality and abuse is normalized behavior. And so prison just further reinforced the idea that this was my lot and that my life had no value and it had no meaning, it had no purpose beyond trying to survive day to day in the, you know, steel jungle known as prison.
There's no corrections. There's no redemption.
No corrections, no redemption. The first few years I was inside, we did have college. And unfortunately, that was taken out of prison due to a crime bill that was passed, you know, by the Clinton administration at the time. There were vocational trades, but all that stuff went away relatively quickly. And so we were pretty much left to our own way of kind of figuring life out, you know. So I worked in the kitchen for 17 cents an hour, started off at 17 cents an hour. I eventually made it up to 34 cents an hour. And outside that, I was in my cell.
And you were so angry, you wound up in the hole. You wound up in solitary a lot. What, about a cumulative 5 years worth of your sentence?
Well, it was a total of out of 19 years I served in prison, seven of that was in solitary confinement. The first couple of times I went were for, you know, altercations with other inmates, altercations with, you know, officers. And they were, by description, they were pretty superficial altercations. But again, we live in a very punitive society, and so the idea that you throw somebody in a cell for 23 hours, locked down a day, 5 days out of the week, and 24 hours the other 2 days out of the week, with the hopes that that's going to change the behavior is just not realistic. 8 years into my incarceration, I was sent to solitary confinement for what turned out to be 4.5 years straight. And it was the most insane, barbaric environment that you can imagine.
How so?
Well, one of the things is that there's extremely high level of mental illness in solitary confinement. It's extremely high level in prison, period, but it's even higher in solitary confinement. And because the officers aren't trained to treat mental illness, they react to, you know, psychotic episodes with brutality and force. When you're in that environment and you're having people who have schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, the way that they engage each other when there are conflicts is to throw feces on each other and urine. And so the environment, that smell is just like forever burnt into my system. The smell of human defecation mixed with pepper spray that the officers use to subdue them. And so it's just a very, very volatile environment. It's no, you have no out of cell activities that speaks to your humanity. 1 hour, 5 times a week, you can go out to what's called a recreation yard, which is really just a dog kennel. And so that was my life for 4.5 years. And it was in that environment that I came face to face with my truest self.